regard, so all in all, it will happen in the holy month of Ramadan, it is for sure. For it to be on the night of the 23rd, we have six narrations, among which there are two authentic narrations. And for it to be on the night before Friday, we have at least one authentic narration.
All right.
We have discussed about this point before, that when it comes to the certain signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, we believe that Bada will not happen. There is no change. But when it comes to the details, Bada may happen.
All right.
This is an important point that we need to
remember into consideration
every time. Yeah. Now, there is a discussion regarding, because we are talking about the time of this heavenly call, and many narrations so far that we have narrated, they talk about, for example, Laylatul Thalathin wa Ashreen, or Laylatul Jum'ah, the night of the 23rd of the month of Ramadan, or the night of Friday, the night before Friday. So we may come to this conclusion that it is a call which will happen at night.
All right.
But the point is that we have, on the other side, some narrations which refer to this fact that it will happen during the day.
Okay.
And now we have seemingly a contradiction between these narrations. So, for example, in one narration we read, Yunadi munadin min as-sama fi awwal an-nahar. A caller will call out from the heaven early in the morning or during the day. Al-Irshad, volume 2, page 371. And Al-Ghiba by Sheikh Al-Tusi, page 454, hadith number 461. Or Yunadi munadin min as-sama awwal an-nahar, it will happen during the day. Kamal al-Din, volume 2, page 558. And also we have one narration in this regard in Al-Kafi, volume 8, page 177. And among these narrations, at least three of them are authentic.
Right.
Now, this is a very important question, that because, when people are waiting for that heavenly call, and if we have also a fake one by Iblis, we'll talk about that later, people need to know about the time as well.
Exactly.
So we have talked about the holy month of Ramadan, the 23rd. Now the question is that, is it going to happen during the night
or during the day? We'll discuss that after a short break. The listeners, stay tuned.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. This thousand-year-old
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. We're talking about certain signs of reappearance. And right now, we're talking about heavenly cry. We discussed that the month, in which month this heavenly cry is going to happen. That's the holy month of Ramadan. Now we have been discussing about the day. According to many narrations, it is said that the 23rd, of Maha Ramadan. Well, now there's a doubt. Is it the day? Is it the night? And in some narrations, it's the Thursday night, a night before Friday. Now, what is it, Dr. Karimi? Is it happening in the day or at the night?
Now, answering this question, because for both possibilities, we have some authentic narrations. That is why there are some theories accepting both groups of the narrations. The first possibility and theory is that, according to the narrations which are about the night of Qad or night of destiny, the day after the Laylatul Qad is like the night of Qadr. in terms of the merits and virtues. For example, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is quoted as saying, Laylatul Qadr fi kull sana, the night of destiny will happen each year. Wa yawmuha mithlu laylataha, and the day of it is like the night. So in terms of the virtue and merit, the day of Qadr, the day of the 23rd, is like the night of the 23rd. So the first explanation for this seemingly contradiction of these narrations is that the day of 23rd of the holy month of Ramadan is also a part of the night in terms of being Laylatul Qadr.
Yeah.
So if this cry happened during the day, I mean early in the morning, it is as if it has happened at the night of destiny or Qadr. This is one explanation.
All right.
The second explanation is that the narrations talking about the fact that it will happen during the day, they call it Awwalun Nahar. Maybe it can be translated as early in the morning. Early in the morning can be called, I mean, night and day.
It could be together. Dawn.
Yeah. And we have some narrations about the time for the virtuous time for dawn prayer, which is, at dawn. So maybe the narrations which talk about Awwal al-Nahar and night, both of them, they are referring to the same point. Time. I mean, early in the morning, which can be considered night as well. The third possibility is that we know that this difference in the narrations is because of different horizons in different places.
Yeah.
When it is the night of destiny in one part of the world, it is the day in another part of the world. So it is very natural and normal because it will happen only once.
So and the difference of this day and night that we have in the narrations could be because of the horizon.
So some people hear it while it is night in that region, in that place of the world, and some people will hear it while it is during the day. Of course, I mentioned it will happen once. In the following session, I will talk about that because according to some notion, it will happen twice. So this is the third possibility. There are two remaining possibilities that I think we need to share in the following
session. In the upcoming sessions, inshallah. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Man who shook the world.
Part one.
I have fought against white domination, and I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society, in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an ideal which I hope to live for and to achieve. But if needs be, this is an ideal for which I am prepared to die. These were the words of a man whose father rightly named Wadi Khlakhla, the shaker of a tree, who shook the world. Mandela was born in a tiny village in South Africa on July 18, 1918. His father, Godla Henry, who had four wives and 13 children, was the principal counselor of the acting chief of Thembelin. The family lived in a traditional hut and raised livestock. On the first day of school, when he started his British education, Mandela was given the British name Nelson by an African teacher.
When I went to school, the lady teacher, Miss Mdingane, asked, "What is your name?" I told her my African name, Rakholisa. She says, "No, I don't want that one. You must have a Christian name." So I say, "No, I don't have one." She says, "You are, from today, you are going to be Nelson."
Following his father's death, when he was only 9, Mandela became the ward of the acting regent of the Thembu people, Chief Jongin Thaba. He was raised lovingly, but with discipline, by the chief and his wife, in the royal household where he was groomed to assume high office. However, influenced by the cases that came before the chief's court, he was determined to become a lawyer. After receiving a good primary education, Mandela entered Fort Hare University and completed 2 years when he was expelled from the school because he refused the offer to stay at Fort Hare and stop opposing the school's policies. Upon his return home, his guardian, the chief, wanted Nelson to marry a woman of his choice. The rebel ward escaped to Johannesburg to avoid the marriage. Nelson arrived there in 1941. In the city, he met Walter Sisulu, his mentor and lifelong friend, who found a position for him in a local law firm, Witkin, Sadelsky, and Edelman. Living in a segregated township, Nelson started to study law via a correspondence course at the University of South Africa. It was in Johannesburg where Mandela experienced the discrimination against the black people, which later became entrenched in law as part of the system of apartheid, which banned the black people from voting, traveling without permission, or even possessing land. At Witkin, Sadelsky, and Edelman, white and black people drank tea in different teacups. When he started to work there, he was given some money to buy himself a tin cup, as only white people had the right to drink tea in china cup. One day a black employee drank his tea in a china cup, purposely thinking the segregation was nonsense. This way, Nelson took his first political lesson. In 1943, Nelson joined the African National Congress, the ANC, fighting against racial discrimination. He realized that his task now was to unite the African people and out of them build a nation. Arguing that the ANC leadership was too staid, Mandela, Sisulu, and Oliver Tambo formed the ANC Youth League in 1944 and planned to organize mass support, making ANC a more activist movement. In the same year, Mandela married Evelyn, a nursing student, and had 4 children with her. In 1948, the Nationalist Party was elected by the white electorate. The Nationalist government enforced the apartheid system, which legalized racial discrimination. The ANC Youth League, presided by Mandela, called for mass strikes, protests, and passive resistance. In 1952, after the government rejected the ANC's calls for legitimate rights for blacks, the ANC launched the Defiance Campaign, a non-violent mass resistance. In the same year, Mandela and Tambo opened the first black law firm in South Africa. Their office in Johannesburg took on many cases involving blacks persecuted under the apartheid laws. In 1953, the ANC and its allied organizations, under the rubric of the Congress Alliance, called for a gathering so the activists from all races would draw up the principles of the Freedom Charter, which urged the formation of a truly democratic society in which justice would be served and there would be no racial prejudice. Nelson Mandela, who had just been released after being tried over his role in the defense campaign, was banned from attending. 1 year later, in 1956, Mandela was arrested along with over 150 other organizers of the Freedom Charter and members of the Congress Alliance. They were charged with high treason. The treason trial, which was aimed at marginalizing the opposition and keeping them out of politics, lasted 4.5 years, and at the end, they were all acquitted. During the years of the trial, Mandela divorced his wife after 13 years due to the strains of his political life, and in 1958, he married Winnie, a social worker. Winnie assumed a more politically active role while Mandela was tied down by his trials, and over the next few years, they had 2 daughters. With the adoption of even harsher apartheid laws by the parliament and their enforcement by the government, tensions escalated even higher in the late 1950s. On March 21, 1960, in the Sharpeville massacre, police shot 69 people dead in protest in the township of Sharpeville. The nationalist government declared martial law and banned the ANC and other opposition groups, jailing thousands. In response, the ANC endorsed an armed struggle, and Mandela went underground and launched a campaign by targeting government offices and symbols of the apartheid. Due to his ability to avoid police, Mandela became known as the Black Pimpernel.
We have made it very clear in our policy that South Africa is a country of many races. There is room for all the various races in this country. There are many people who feel that it is useless and futile for us to continue talking peace and non-violence against a government whose reply is only savage attacks on an unarmed and defenseless people.
In 1961, ANC's armed wing, Spear of the Nation, was formed and Mandela became its commander-in-chief. 1 year later in 1962, Mandela illegally left the country to speak to Ethiopia and address the conference of the Pan-African Freedom Movement of East and Central Africa. Upon his return, Mandela was arrested and sentenced to 5 years in prison, charged with illegally leaving the country. Despite already serving a sentence, Mandela was brought to trial again, along with other ANC leaders, and was charged with sabotage, where he faced a possible death penalty. However, after making his historical statement at the opening of his trial, Mandela received a life sentence and was taken to Robben Island Prison. At the age of 45, Mandela became prisoner number 466/64. Which is prisoner 466 of 1964. While in prison and performing futile hard labor in a lime quarry, his reputation grew and he became widely known as the most significant black leader in South Africa. During these years, he undertook study with the University of London via correspondence and received a BA in law. Outside, issues were far from settled. In 1976, and over a course of 8 months, 575 people were killed as a result of the students' protest against mandatory instruction in Afrikaans, the language of the white ruler. 1/4 of these 575 people were under 18.
Which says that a man's legal status, a man's political rights, a man's economic opportunities, a man's social position shall depend solely upon the color of his skin.
In Meanwhile, his wife, an uncompromising activist, who continued to fight against apartheid, spent over a year in jail and faced constant police harassment. Consequently, she became even more aggressive and militant in opposing white rule. In 1980, the exiled Tambo and the ANC launched the Release Mandela campaign, in which numerous countries and international groups signed petitions, passed resolutions, and held rallies for Mandela's release.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners from all around the world. Back to reality again. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. Today, I have the honor to be in this episode of Back to Reality. And with me, there are two dear guest speakers, Brother Dawood and Brother Mehdi. Assalamu alaikum, brothers.
Assalamu alaikum. I am Dawood, and I am very happy to be at your service.
Alaikum assalam.
Could you please introduce yourself briefly for me and the listeners?
Hello everyone, I'm Mehdi. I'm here in Qum for the last 6 years studying the seminary.
Thank you. And Brother Dawood?
Assalamu alaikum.
Salam.
I am Dawood and I have been teaching English for over 25 years and I've got MA in TEFL, teaching English as a foreign language.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to have you both in here. As you know, we're human beings, and despite the fact that human beings are some social creatures, but at the end, we feel like lonely, no matter how we are, no matter we are married, single, in a group of friends, in a family, no matter where we are, there is always this feeling of loneliness that we feel in our souls. You know, but first of all, I always
who feels this?
Don't you feel lonely?
Loneliness, no.
So you are a kind of exception creature. I don't have nothing to do with you.
Why you like
this? I don't want to generalize things, but actually, this is a fact. Okay, so first of all, you have to tell me that do you feel lonely?
No. Are you lonely, brother?
No, I'm not lonely. I don't feel lonely. But there are some moments in everybody's life that they feel you are lonely. You feel like you are not being...
No, you didn't say that. No, you didn't say that. There's some times that someone feels lonely. You said, you know, everyone always has a sense of loneliness.
Sometimes you are surrounded by some people, but yet you feel lonely. Man as a gregarious human or being was born and raised within the society, within the community of people. So it is very much unnatural to say that I am lonely. But there are some moments that you feel you are not being understood by the people around you. And this will make you lonely, and perhaps this loneliness is preferable at that time, even if you are surrounded by some people. You prefer to be on your own and enjoy your, let's say, loneliness. I don't know if it is right to call it enjoy, but when you are in the misery of a wrong company, you have to mention enjoy it. You enjoy your...
Yeah, there's joy in being lonely. So, dear listeners, I have to keep you alone for a minute and then we're going to come back to accompany you.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
We're at
talking about loneliness and this feeling of being alone, and I come to this point that, okay, there are times, sometimes, in everybody's life that we may feel lonely. But I think there is a difference between the loneliness of people who are married and the people who are single. And I assume both of you are married, so I want your opinion on this, that are there any differences in being lonely when you're married and we're not?
There's loneliness and there's solitude.
Yeah. Right. They are two different separate things.
Precisely. Loneliness is, of course, detrimental.
Yeah.
Physical and mental health. The feeling of being lonely. And has been the root cause of a lot of people who've committed suicides. Right. People have ended their own lives out of loneliness because, as you mentioned, they feel that no one understands them in this world. Right. By the way, like I'm going to talk here within brackets, like this is when faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the fact that he's always there with you helps you, and you can communicate with him and realize that there is someone who understands you anyway. And so talking about like solitude. Yeah, I am married and being by myself, right? I think solitude, not in the sense of being lonely, yeah. Right? Solitude, I've always had that craving, you know, even before I was married, because we had rented a house, you know, like when you move out, I'd moved out.
Yeah.
When I was 17, I'd moved out of my house and, I rented a room at first, and then we rented a house with other housemates. You know, like when back in the day, that's how you live. At that time, you're mostly surrounded with people. Even at that time, once in a while, you need to go to your room, close the door, and, you know, let yourself heal. You understand? Because, yeah, you know, the society... It takes little pieces off of you, your mental health and your physical
consumer
health.
Consumer energy.
You know, it takes it. So you need that time to recover. You actually do, and, you know, and I don't know, like, if my wife's listening, as you said, but, like, even more so when you're married. After you're married, you need that time a lot more, you understand?
Oh, my gosh. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, you're like, okay, I have had enough for today, please.
I want
to be alone. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, you want to be, like, unbothered and everything. And when you've got, like, toddlers at home, you know? Yeah, so...
So you need it more, but do you have it more? I don't think so.
No.
You have less time than the time we're single.
You know, well, everything comes back to the human being very ungrateful, you know.
Yeah.
People wanting your help or, you know, people that you have around you are a blessing. And, of course, you know, instead of acknowledging that, yeah, it does happen sometimes that we want to be unbothered. And, yeah, sometimes we get a little bit of that and sometimes we don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how about you, your brother David? Do you feel lonely? And is there any difference between your loneliness when you were single and now you're married?
Yes, I remember I was lonely before marriage because I was always left to my own devices when I was... I didn't have much communications with my siblings since they were much older than me. And of course, They were physically apart from me. My brothers and sisters were living... with their own families, and I had to remain alone at home. And I had a younger brother who was also in another city for education and for doing his military service. And I was obliged to remain lonely, or let's say alone, not lonely, because of the natural causes of being alone.
You're sick of
it. But after marriage, you know, the first condition that I have to tell you to opt my wife was to find someone that matches my personality and to create or to build up a perfect life after marriage. So, however, I have to mention that it cannot be necessarily possible for people to find someone who really matches their personality, because we are living with our similarities and difference. Even if you look at your fingers, you cannot see much similarity between them. They are living together peacefully within their differences.
Their own unique ways.
Yeah. I had my own way of life with my wife. We are living together peacefully, although we have some differences. She has got her own standard of life from her own family, and we started to get to know each other and to come to agreement in some respect.
Did you feel the urgent need to be in solitude for some while, as Brother Mehdi also mentioned?
However, sometimes you will experience a level of repetition in your married life, and this is the time when you feel like you need to some space on your own to refresh or to recover. Another point that I have to mention is that, there are some times that you need to, especially it depends on your type of personality, whether you are an introvert or extrovert. Even if you are living peacefully with your life partner, you need some time to recover. For example, I myself personally, I am a kind of introvert person. So I need to remain alone to gain energy and to refresh and to prepare myself for a better partnership for the next stage of life. That could be tomorrow. I mean, sometimes in my house, I have a small basement where I can study, and this is the time when I enjoy my solitude to study and to prepare a better stage of married life, to study and to answer my wife's problem. Mm-hmm.
I think marriage is kind of a special and unique opportunity that may occur in your life or may not. And when somebody is really involved into your life, it means that you have to, you have to give them some special space, some special, proxies of your love towards them. And this actually needs your energy, especially if you're an introvert person. And this need and this urge for being in a solitude after being married that will become higher, I think, in most of the people, is something really natural, in my opinion. And I think there should be a kind of mutual understanding of this happening in couples, partners, and everything. And me needs this solitude after especially communicate with people so much. And at the end of our speaking, I want to tell you that everybody is living in their own special and unique way, as you both mentioned. And we have to find our own special way of improvement, whether it's in solitude or whether it's in communication with other people, which I believe there should be a balance.
Right. And there's positive solitude and there's negative solitude.
Yeah,
also, like, of course, if someone is, you know, by himself trying to enjoy solitude, he might enjoy his solitude, but that solitude is the thoughts that he's going through, the way he's analyzing things might be incorrect. And as a result, he could affect his life negatively.
So
the quality of the time that you spend, the quality of that time with your family also has to be improved.
Exactly.
And that time that you're spending by yourself has to be of help and aid to your life.
Yeah, exactly.
Be it solid or be it by yourself or within the community or your family.
And a good example leading your speech is about two great poets of Persian literature, which are Sa'di and Hafez, who were great people. And, you know, despite the fact that most of the people think these people were isolated, they were parted and departed and estranged from other people, it's not like that. You know, they were engaged and involved with other people, and their books and their masterpieces were actually a result of their communication with other people, their traveling, and their brilliant experiences in relation with human beings. So it's not like you think you can heal yourself only in solitude. Sometimes you have to go into society, you have to show and manifest yourself and just be judged, you know. Sometimes you have to put aside your fears and be yourself. So, unfortunately, it was all the time we had for today's episode about loneliness. At the end, the key point is the balance between these two and finding your right way. Thank you for listening to us. It was all the time we had. I bid you farewell, and I leave you in a warm embrace of Allah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again. Once again.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio. For those who seek the truth.
Rabbana, Rabbana.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be looking at a very significant question, and that question is tied up to the month in which we are currently in. As you know, we are in the month of Muharram. In fact, we are in the first 10 days of Muharram. As you know, the month of Muharram is a very significant month of the Islamic calendar. It is a very sad and solemn day for the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam, as well as for Muslims in general, and also for all of the freedom-loving, justice-loving people of the world. Because as you know, in this month, Imam Hussein, alayhi salam, was martyred along with some of his closest companions and some of his family members on the plains of Karbala. In their opposition to some of the corrupt and tyrannical policies of the government of their time. And for this, we would like to offer our condolences again to our esteemed listeners. You know, as you know, the Imam Hussein held a high status in the eyes of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Many hadiths have been related from the Prophet regarding his stature. We don't need to go into that. So this is indeed a very solemn and very sad day. In today's session of The Key, the question we want to address is regarding the rule of wicked people. The rule of wicked people, the rule and the governance of people, evil people. Now, what is the result of it? What happens when we allow such wicked people to rule over us, right? Unfortunately, we have an answer to this question. You know, obviously, we know that it's bad, but we don't know, to know the details of it. We can take reference to some prophetic hadith in which the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he alludes to this, to the answer to this question. The Prophet has been reported as having said, "When your rulers are the best ones from among you, and the richest people from among you are the most generous, and your affairs are settled by counsel between yourselves, then being above the ground," meaning living in this world, being alive, "will be better for you than being under it," meaning it will be better for you to live than die. The Prophet mentioned three very important and significant traits. First of all, the rulers should be the best of people. Best from all points of view. First of all, from a theoretical point of view, they should be knowledgeable. They should be experienced. They should have know-how in the field that they want to work in. And they should be also the most virtuous. They should be best from a practical point of view. At the same time, the rich people, the wealthy, should be generous. And, the affairs of the government and, the society, they should be settled with, by means of counsel. It shouldn't be that one person is taking, making decisions for everybody else without consulting them. In this situation, life is better than death. The Prophet then adds, "But when your rulers are the wicked ones from among you, and the richest, the most miserly, then being under the ground will be better for you than being above it." Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the rule of wicked people and its consequences in the light of the prophetic hadith. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Midstream.
After the Israeli aggression on the Jenin camp and amid silence by the Jenin Brigade and the Palestinian factions, President of the Palestinian Authority Mahmoud Abbas visited the city of Jenin, apparently as part of a plan to regain control of the city. The visit, which is Abbas's first since he assumed office 17 years ago, sparked popular criticism of the authority in light of the enormity of the security measures that it surrounded it. Many residents sarcastically asked about the position of these forces in protecting the Palestinian citizens who were subjected to barbaric attacks just a few days ago, amid clear anger towards Ramallah, which was evident by chants in support of the Jenin Battalion. Before Abbas's arrival, 300 members of the Presidential Guard arrived in the city to secure the visit, not against any Israeli threats, but against whom exactly? No one knows. Meanwhile, the leadership of the Fatah movement mobilized its masses to show a kind of popular rally around Abu Mazen. However, local sources revealed that the number of those who participated in the reception of Abbas was meager and was estimated at hundreds, including citizens, individuals, and members of the security services affiliated with the authority itself. On the purpose of the visit, sources in the authority revealed that Abbas's move falls within the plan drawn up by security leaders to regain control of the Jenin camp, which includes strengthening the presence and power of the security services and carrying out a campaign of arrests against members of the Hamas and Islamic Jihad movements. So the man came in after 50 hours of brutal fighting, destruction, displacement, yet nonetheless unwavering victory to finish what Israel failed to achieve. The plan, which was approved by Abbas after his meeting with the leaders of the security services last week in Ramallah, requires starting the process of confiscating weapons, preventing armed manifestations in the camp, and carrying out arrest operations for a list of people from the city of Jenin in the first stage, up to the implementation of arrests in Jenin camp as a second stage. In return, Netanyahu is to present proposals for facilities in the interest of the Palestinian Authority, including the establishment of an industrial zone near Hebron, the granting of soft loans, the scheduling of Palestinian debts, the provision of fuel exemptions, the advancement of the date for the transfer of tax revenues, as well as an increase in working hours on the Al-Karama crossing, and returning the permits of the VIP visitors to the authority officials. Such an honor for Mahmoud Abbas, really. I'll just stop here before what I might say becomes inappropriate for broadcast. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas arrived last Wednesday in the city of Jenin and its camp to see the conditions of the citizens and the progress of work in the reconstruction of the camp after the recent Israeli attacks on the camp during Operation Jenin Force a few weeks ago. This step comes at a time when the Palestinian Authority and behind it the Fatah movement has become more aware of their declining popularity among the Palestinians, particularly in the city of Jenin and its camp. In addition to dozens of cases of collision between the security services against citizens and resistance fighters in the West Bank. To discuss this issue with us from the occupied Al-Quds is Mr. Anan Najib, political commentator and head of the Beit Al-Maqdis news agency. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Anan. Now, the Palestinian Authority aspires to restore this popularity through Abu Mazen's visit, and perhaps to open some sort of a new page with the local community in the city of Jenin and its camp as well, and to support the security forces inside the city. Now, they want to strengthen their position, especially after the emergence of the Palestinian resistance in the camp victorious as a retaliation against the aggression against the camp by the Zionists. Now, they are obviously reinforced by the popular environment, by the support of the people, and we saw that maybe the Palestinian Authority wants to grab that, hijack that. How do you assess the visit of Mahmoud Abbas last week to Jenin?
In the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. Mr. Mahmoud Abbas's visit to Jenin government, specifically in the Jenin camp, is due to two main reasons, in my opinion. The first reason is to improve the bad image that has been imprinted in the minds of the Palestinian street in general and the Arab international public opinion. After the Palestinian Authority system, supervised by Mr. Mahmoud Abbas, has been shaken, especially after the recent visit by members of the Fatah Central Committee to the Jenin camp, during which the camp residents expelled those delegates on behalf of Fatah and the Palestinian National Authority. Therefore, the visit, in my opinion, is among the failed moves by the Palestinian Authority to try to restore its position in the West Bank. In light of the unprecedented failure of the Palestinian political leadership to defend its besieged people everywhere in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and dispersed in the countries of the diaspora.
One very important issue, Mr. was that Abbas's visit raises questions about the approach that the authority will be making towards the city of Jenin and the Jenin camp in specific in the upcoming next phase, because considering the occupation's pressure on it to play more of a role that the occupation itself cannot play, they're pushing Mahmoud Abbas to play that role, and the facilities that the enemy government intends and promises to provide to the Palestinian Authority in order to strengthen it and maybe help it regain its some of its prestige, let's say, inside of the city and the camp. Does that insinuate a possibility of a clash between the Palestinian security forces and the Palestinian resistance factions, especially in Jenin?
I believe that there is a state of awareness prevailing among the segments of Palestinian society in the West Bank. There is a popular mood that rejects the shedding of Palestinian blood among the sons of the security services and the sons of the resistance. Attempts to shed Palestinian blood are not new attempts. Not as long as the Zionist occupation, along with the United States of America, works hard to see a clash of Palestinian blood on the ground through internal fighting. But we as Palestinians who support the line of resistance count on the awareness of the resistance fighters to prevent us from being drawn into a series of spilled blood inside the Palestinian interior. But honestly, everything is possible. There is a fierce attack by the Palestinian security forces to detain the resistance fighters in all the governance of the West Bank. There are restrictions on the resistance fighters everywhere in the West Bank. Unfortunately, this increases the Palestinian streets' congestion towards the PA's security services. But as I said, we are counting on the awareness of the Palestinian population, so as not to be dragged into such battles, even if some try to drag us into them. And I mean here specifically the occupation and the Arab Zionists, and behind them the United States of America.
Well, Mr. Annan, the Palestinian security sources revealed that there was a regional American-Israeli agreement with the Palestinian authorities that was forged in Jordan and in Egypt, followed by intensive contacts to confront the growing resistance forces, especially in the West Bank. Many measures have been agreed upon with the Palestinian authorities, sadly, which include increasing deployment of the Palestinian Authority forces in Jenin and maybe entering the camp in the upcoming period, which leads to reducing the activity of the resistance. They hope that it would reduce the activity of the resistance in the camp. How do you think that will work out if the Palestinian Authority actually goes ahead and implements what the Zionist entity wants?
I believe that this agreement, which we have read in various media, is not new. The Palestinian National Authority has always concluded agreements with the occupation under the auspices of the United States of America, and with the partnership and sponsorship of some Arab countries such as Jordan, Egypt, and the Arab normalization countries in the Persian Gulf. Thus, this matter is not new to the Palestinian people, and it is not surprising that this comes from such regimes and authorities whom themselves are aware that their job is to defend this usurping entity. As I said before, we are counting on awareness within the Palestinian street in order not to fall into the trap of internal fighting. Although we see on the ground that there are preparations on the part of the Palestinian Authority, with its security services and also with its economic and social arms, in order to control specifically the Nablus government and Jenin government in the north in order to eliminate resistance. In order to control specifically the Nablus government and Jenin government in the north in order to eliminate the resistance. This resistance, which has proven in the past days and even in the past months that it is difficult to defeat and difficult to break. There are attempts to destroy it through the attack initiated by the entirety of the Zionist entity, with more than 1,000 soldiers armed with all the weapons known to humanity in order to eliminate a few dozen young fighters, in a geographical area of less than 1 kilometer, but this entity failed. Therefore, the National Authority will not succeed, and agreements with Western countries will not succeed. And also, with the participation of the countries of normalization under the United States to eliminate the hawks of resistance in the occupied territories. A resistance that is not represented by a specific person or faction. Today it has become a culture and an idea spread among Palestinian people. The different segments of the Palestinian people have come to see the Jenin camp model and the old town model in Nablus as the model that must be followed in order to achieve our freedom from this occupation and reclaim our lands. Therefore, we count on the awareness of the Palestinian people and on the steadfastness of these resistance fighters. And we also count on the independent axis in the region, which we call the axis of resistance. As long as this axis fully supports the Palestinian resistance, as long as it acts as the arm and back for the resistance fighters in Palestine and in the occupied land, then I believe that more internal solidarity between the axis of resistance and the Palestinian people will thwart the plans of the occupation, the plans of the Palestinian Authority, and the plans of Arab normalization countries who aim to eliminate the resistance in the occupied land.
Definitely. Well, Mr. Anan Najib, it's always a pleasure having you with us. Anan Najib, political commentator and head of the Bayt al-Maqdis News Agency. Thank you very much for your contribution to our show. Please, ladies and gents, stay tuned, because next we'll be talking about the relationship between Turkey and NATO.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Before the last elections and the weeks and months that preceded them, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan threatened America, NATO, and the countries of the European Union and said more than once that he will not agree to let Sweden into the alliance. However, there was no real surprise that he retracted everything that he said, especially after his phone call with the U.S. President Joe Biden, who said a day after this call that he does support Turkey's accession to the European Union, but he thinks that this is a purely European matter. More details in this following report.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan surprised his allies in NATO before the NATO summit, which took place last week, by setting a new condition that seems difficult to achieve, which is opening the door to Turkey's entry into the European Union in exchange for Ankara opening the door to Sweden's entry into the alliance. Before the last elections and the weeks and months that preceded them, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan had resorted to issuing threats against the United States of America, the NATO, and the countries of the European Union, and said more than once that he will not agree to Sweden's accession to the alliance. No one was surprised, though, that he retracted everything that he said, especially after his phone call with President Biden, who said a day after this call, "We support Turkey's accession to the European Union, but this is a purely European matter." This is what Sweden's Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson also said after Erdogan agreed to his country's accession to the alliance, promising him to lift the ban on Swedish military sales to Turkey, with other non-binding promises to coordinate with Ankara in combating terrorism, which is meant by the Turkish Kurdistan Workers' Party PKK and the YPG. At a time when the diplomatic community is ruling out that Erdogan will receive any support from the European Union, which Turkey has been waiting at its gate for 70 years. Now, the most important aspect of Erdogan's position is his provocation of Russia 2 days before the NATO summit. President Erdogan extended an urgent and surprising invitation to Ukrainian President Zelensky to visit him in Istanbul, to return from there with five of the most infamous leaders of the fascist Azov group, whom Moscow handed over to Ankara as part of a prisoner exchange deal, but on the condition that they remain in Turkey until the end of the war. The second Turkish provocation came with the agreement signed between the two parties, which includes building a military complex to manufacture and develop Turkish drones inside Ukraine, in addition to other areas of military cooperation. As for the third provocation, it came when Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan met with the leaders of the Muslim minority of Turkish origin in the Crimea region, which Ankara considers occupied by the Russians. Erdogan's announcement of his support for Ukraine's accession to NATO is the most important indicator of a possible change in Ankara's policies towards Moscow. Meanwhile, President Putin, who had previously complained about similar Turkish positions, including Zelensky's non-compliance with the Istanbul Agreement regarding the withdrawal of Russian forces from Kiev in exchange for a comprehensive Russian-Turkish agreement and with Turkish guarantees, is highly expected to cancel his scheduled visit to Ankara next month. With a potential Russian position to respond to the unsurprising change in President Erdogan's position, it remains to be seen if Ankara in the next stage will be on Washington's side more than it is now with Moscow.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Istanbul is Mr. Hosni Mahalli, researcher in international relations and expert in Turkish affairs. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Mahalli. Now, controversy continues to escalate over Erdogan's sudden approval of Swedish membership in NATO, especially due to his connection between the accession of the Scandinavian country and the revival of Turkey's accession into the European Union. What is your take on such a maneuver by Mr. Erdogan? And do you think that Europe will allow Turkey, in, especially at such a unprecedented times in European history, to join the European Union?
There is no maneuver because, one, Turkey has been a member of NATO for 7 years. Two, Turkey is a strategic ally of the US. Three, NATO has about 30 bases inside Turkish territory. What President Erdogan did was nothing but internal propaganda to deceive the Turkish people, as is the case in most other issues with regard to foreign policy. When he threatened the Emirates, Saudi Arabia,